Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. This is where we talk with authors who are not necessarily seasoned writers, but from different occupations outside and across the spectrum. We talk with people who have overcome great diversity on this show, and my guest today has had more than his share. From a remote village in Ghana, following his dreams to look for the life he wanted in America, Patrick Asare documents his trials and trails, or trails and trials, you can pick whichever one in the book, The Boy from Bwadwa, I hope I pronounced that correctly, One African's Journey of Hunger and Sacrifice in Pursuit of a Dream. Patrick Asare, welcome to Book Spectrum.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Your story is amazing. It's almost the stuff made of a fiction book in a lot of ways, because people aren't going to believe the things you've been through. So that's why I'm glad you're here. Tell us about growing up in Bwadwa.
Yes, and thank you for your kind words about my book. So I grew up in a small dusty village in Ghana, West Africa. And I was one of 14 children born to two illiterate parents who had no formal education. And so my father worked as a subsistence farmer. And my mother just was a homemaker who stayed at home and took care of the children. And so my parents, without any education in that village environment, were really poor. And feeding 14 children and trying to put them through school was a challenge. To say that was a challenge would be an understatement. So went hungry most of the time because there was never enough food at home to feed all those mouths. And so the village had a small elementary school and a middle school, and this was a place with very low expectations. About 99% of the parents in the village were illiterate, just like my parents were. And so education was never a priority for anyone. Children mostly did chores at home from dawn to about 8 a.m. in the morning. And then they went to the primary school to get a bit of an education. And then any spare minute we got, we worked on farms. And so chores at home, carrying buckets of water from a river, which was about a mile away from the house, and doing that and doing farm work and all kinds of chores at home before school in the morning. So that was the kind of life we lived in the village. The elementary school, I started school under a tree, really, because there were not enough classrooms in the primary school. So my first in kindergarten, I sat under a tree and listened to a teacher who had an easel out in the open. And that was the life, basic description of life in the village.
From what you're saying, it would seem like the government of Ghana, at least at the time, almost ignored education in remote areas.
I actually, that's a fascinating question, actually. The government, actually, the reason I'm talking about the environment that way was education. The government was in the capital, Accra, and the village of Bwadwa was never on any map in Ghana when I was growing up there. So it's like you lived in the country, but nobody knew you were there, because a tiny village with everyone being a farmer basically, and so the government didn't really know we existed. And in theory, education was mandated, but because the government didn't know where we lived and who was there, there was basically no supervision from anyone. So it was almost like an optional thing for most parents. I mean, they could send their kids to school or put them on to work on their farms. And that's what most people did.
And you had to survive anyway. All countries have disadvantaged communities, a problem that we in the West are still trying to resolve in many different ways. We look at them, or at least our media looks at disadvantaged urban areas and doesn't pay much attention to disadvantaged rural areas.
Yes,
we have those. But in Ghana, yes, Yours are very disadvantaged, or your village was extremely disadvantaged at the time. Talk about the gap between the advantaged and disadvantaged communities and the challenges they faced in Ghana and still face?
Yes. So the as I described, the villages really, most of them were not on the national map. And unlike America, where most, I would say most children born in this country have at least a birth certificate and you are assigned a social security number and all kinds of identification. So in most parts of America, you live here, and even in the rural areas, I mean, you are still counted. But that wasn't the case in Ghana when I was growing up there. I mean, there were most thousands of people growing up in the kind of village I grew up in who no one knew existed in the country. And so you were out there on your own, you know, talking about disadvantage. I mean, people like my parents were really fending for themselves. I mean, there was a government, but the government had very little involvement in anyone's life in that kind of environment. And so you it was almost like you lived in a deep jungle somewhere, primitive sort of population that survived on scraps in the jungle, and that was the life that we lived. And so, yeah, that was the life.
With me is Patrick Asari. He's the author of The Boy from Bantwa, One African's Journey of Hunger and Sacrifice in Pursuit of a Dream. Patrick, in your situation, it had to be tough, but the options were venture out of the village and do something different with your life, or stay, live with family, create your own, and farm.
Yes.
When was it you decided you desired to leave the village and get an education?
Yes. So in all the years I was growing up in this village, starting kindergarten and going to the primary school and middle school, in all the years I was growing up, a lot of kids went through that same process, and I didn't see anyone go anywhere. So as I started saying, nothing was expected of any child born there. So you got the primary education, and most children didn't even make it to the middle school. So you ended up just falling back and working on the farm. And so that was the expectation. What changed for me was when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I realized that even in that environment, I realized that I love to read. I mean, things are written on paper. So, and this was a village with no library, no books in the schools. And so that love of reading at an early age, I didn't really have anything to satisfy that appetite. And I cannot really explain what gave me that reading appetite. So what happened was I was walking around the village one morning, and vendors who sold had food stands in the village. I mean, they used to wrap the food they sold in old newspaper papers, and so people will finish eating their food and they will just discard the scraps of paper. So I was walking around the village and I came upon one of these scraps of paper one morning. And I picked it up and I started reading it. And I read something on that paper that just blew my mind. And that is what eventually took me out of the village. That the discovery I made on this piece of paper is what took me out of the village on this journey that eventually took me to the Soviet Union and ultimately to America. So that was the... out of the 60 kids, I mean, I was one of 60 children that started primary school in the village. And at the end of the middle school, I was the only one that was able to leave the village, which was the first one in a very, very long time.
Leaving the village to go to school is a lot different from most countries.
Yes.
Where you can take a drive, or your parents or somebody brings you over to another college, you apply over the mail, that sort of thing.
Yes.
It was a bit harder for you. I want to put all this in perspective. Let's go to your college years in the U.S.
Yes.
Or at least how you got to college and how you had to pay for it. In the U.S., we have students who go to college for 4 to 7 years, party, take useless curricula, whatever PC studies. They do. Not all people do this. Not all students do this, but many do. And yes, those are the ones who are demanding that student loans be paid off for them by the taxpayers.
Yes.
Let's put, as I said, this in perspective, Patrick. You went through a lot, including yes, the dangerous work, like taking your vacations and working in a jungle farm and yes, with dangerous insects and snakes, yes, having to do loads of chores, heavy duty chores and things like that.
Yes.
Not lack of sleep, not eating enough.
Yes.
You had to go through all that to pay for your education.
Yes. Yes. So talking about paying for education. So I had this dream of attending the most exclusive secondary school in Ghana, which here can be is the equivalent of high school in America. So when I say I picked up this scrap of newspaper and read something on it, what I read was I discovered the most exclusive secondary school in Ghana. And standing in the middle of that dusty village, I don't know why it occurred to me that it was a completely ridiculous idea. I mean, to occur to a nine-year-old that he wanted to go to the most elite school in the country. From this village. I mean, this was a school that was set up by the colonial governors when Ghana was a colony of England. And so this school educated the children of diplomats and ministers, university professors, and things like that. So you're talking about a nine-year-old son of two illiterate parents who you're standing in the middle of this village and this idea occurs to me. So I start on this journey to gain admission to the school. And surprisingly, I was able to get into that school, but realized at that point that I knew that I was hungry all the time, but poverty, the word poverty was what's not in my vocabulary. So it was at that point that I realized my parents couldn't remotely, you know, it wasn't even remotely possible for them to pay the tuition in this place. So what saved me was, so I had to give up that opportunity. And then the next year, I retook the entrance exam. And that is when this fortune came in. The government used to run a scholarship for cocoa farmers. My father was a cocoa farmer. He cultivated cocoa crops. And so he, because of that, I qualified for that scholarship. And that is what enabled me to go to secondary school. And other than that, I would have been walking, I would still be walking around the village today. So I went to secondary school on that scholarship. And that is what got me that education that then took me to college in the Soviet Union.
So what made you go to college in the Soviet Union? We now know, or we've all known, that it's a rather oppressive government, but
yes,
what made you say, hey, I think I'll go to the Soviet Union and go to college?
Yeah. So my idea, actually coming back to that scrap of newspaper, what really impressed me what I read on that paper was this elite school in Ghana that educated the children of the elite in Ghana. It was sort of a school from which students went from there to Oxford and Cambridge universities in England. So growing up in all of middle school, that was my goal, to go to one day end up in England and study at either Cambridge or Oxford. So when I eventually realized how poor my family was and how, you know, unrealistic that whole idea goal was, I just reset my expectations and just went through the secondary school system. And so when I graduated from secondary school, I actually got admission to the university in Ghana. And at that point, the financial issue came in again, and so I couldn't go to university in Ghana. So I bounced around the village for another couple or so years, And at that point, that's when I discovered this scholarship that the Soviet government used to offer students from third world countries. This was the early 1980s and sort of the height of the Cold War. And as you recall, the U.S. and the Soviets were going around the world jockeying for influence. So Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia places, all those places. So the Soviet government had instituted a scholarship program where they invited qualified students from most of African countries and other third world places to go to the Soviet Union. And I had run out of options. I finished secondary school and walking around in the village for about 2 years. I didn't have any options. And so I heard about this scholarship and I went to apply for it. And fortunately, won one. And that was the only choice I had. So I went to the Soviet Union and went to college there. That's how that happened.
Patrick Asari is with me on Book Spectrum. Check out his book, The Boy from Baudoua, One African's Journey of Hunger and Sacrifice in Pursuit of a Dream. You came to America later on.
Yes.
What were you expecting when you got here? Because you wound up teaching in an inner city school district in Buffalo,
yes,
New York.
Yes.
What were you expecting to see, considering you were on the other side of the world for so long and probably heard so many different things while in Ghana and, of course, in the Soviet Union?
Yes.
And what was different, yes, from what you were expecting when accepting that job teaching in the Buffalo system?
Yes. So when I came to America in early 1992, I had majored in electrical engineering in college in the Soviet Union. And while studying, I think it was my third or fourth year, I found out about this option. All foreign students, this option was open to all foreign students. So regardless of what you are majoring in, you had an opportunity to take a certification program, a study program to qualify to teach Russian when you went back to your home country. So I at the beginning, I thought it was a useless proposition because I was an engineer and I had no idea I would ever teach anywhere. But eventually, I got into this program. And so I got my electrical engineering diploma. And in addition to that, I got this teaching certificate. So when I came to America, I went to live with a friend in Buffalo, New York. And there were a couple of magnet schools that had just started offering Russian. Teaching Russian to kindergartners to about fourth grade. So they were looking for a Russian teacher. So I showed up at the Board of Education office and applied for the job. And they thought I was ridiculous. A black guy walking around in Buffalo thinking he knows enough Russian to actually teach it. And so
that must have perplexed people over there.
Oh, yes, yes. So I was... it was like they looked at me like I was some UFO or something.
Because you had to really prove that you knew Russian.
Exactly. So fortunately, I had carried my teaching certificate and my passport to identify myself. So they looked at it and they realized that I was the real deal. So they offered me the job on the spot. And then within a week or two, I started teaching. The Russian classes I was teaching, little kids, kindergarten to about fourth grade. So very eager to learn and model students all around. And then the Board of Education also learned that I was an engineering student. I had been an engineering student and I was an engineer. So they asked me to teach math and science in addition to the Russian. So the math was in middle and high schools. And so when I first went into my math class, that was quite a revelation. I walk into the math classroom and it was pandemonium, total chaos with...
with throwing erasers around and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And so I as someone who had grown up in Ghana, our schools were very different. These were schools where discipline was the order of the day, and orderly classrooms. Our teachers had a lot of authority, and as students, we were always terrified of our teachers. I mean, it was corporal punishment, and you were punished for the slightest thing. I mean, no kid would ever, think about disrespecting a teacher or disobeying any instructions.
You found that quite the opposite here, I suppose.
Exactly. So that was quite a surprise. And so that first math class, I mean, I walk into the class and found this scene, and I was flabbergasted. So I stood for several minutes just watching what I was looking at, and so that was quite an introduction to America for me. And all the disciplinary problems, the dysfunction we read about every day in our urban school districts, I saw all of that on that first day. And in the subsequent 2 years, I taught in that school district. And so that really became another source of education for me. I really wanted to understand what was the factors that were driving that picture I saw. And so I talked to colleagues, and they started, telling me about some of those factors: poverty, broken homes, parental absenteeism, and all of that.
And people aren't allowed to talk about that now. So if you can't do that, no one's going to solve the problem.
Yes.
And it will make things worse generations later. It's not helping anybody just dancing around and trying to be politically correct. Yes. You have to help the people, these kids that are growing up now, and help their kids.
Yes. Yes.
And education is important in that. And I believe it seems like, and I read this in your book, it seems like you have tried to take an initiative to help these kids maybe move forward using your own experiences to do so.
Yes. Yes. So exactly right. So what you're saying about the way we talk about these problems is itself a problem. So I realized quickly the sort of the sensitive nature of these topics. I had just come into the country, and as an African, I had learned about slavery and that whole history. So we had learned about it in schools, and But I knew that slavery had long ended. So before I came to America in 1992, my idea of America was a place where people lived harmoniously, and there weren't the level of poverty and the dysfunction I came to see. So that was a big surprise. I mean, to me, to come to America and see all of that. And so as I started talking to colleagues in those first few weeks when I came to this realization that there was a lot more to America than I had envisaged, and listening to how my teacher colleagues were describing the issue, and then watching debates on television and stuff like that, I quickly realized, I mean, how sensitive some of those things were. And so as an immigrant, I went on this other 20-year journey or so, and started reading about books about the education system and all the problems, especially in the urban areas, the cultural factors, the poverty, the racism, and everything that is associated with the dysfunction. And it became sort of an educational journey for me, because I am a Black male, and that was one of the reasons I was actually asked to teach math and science. As a black male who was highly educated, the school principal and some of the teachers wanted me as a role model in some of these schools I was teaching in. But as I observed the schools and the people in it and everything associated with that, I realized how complicated the issue was. And so it was for me, it was sort of untangling this maze of issues that combined to create that dysfunction. And, you know, even as a black male, it became difficult for me to, you know, talk about it without sounding either naive or insensitive. So I write in the prologue of the book that that's one of the reasons I waited about 20 years to start writing the book. I really wanted to make sure that I understood the issues. And so, but the longer I waited, I mean, the more I realized that I had to put pen to paper because I had some perspectives as an outsider who had come in and seen this picture. I mean, I thought I had some perspectives to share. And so that's what I tried to do in the book.
As people read the book, and it's The Boy from Baudouin, the one African's Journey of Hunger and Sacrifice in Pursuit of a Dream, Patrick Asari is my guest. He's the author. As people read it, they will see you traveled not only around the world, but have lived and worked with people of various cultures, many parts of the globe, and from many different backgrounds. Today's media and politicians in the U.S., as you probably have noticed, tend to emphasize and take advantage of our differences. Your book is also refreshing, as you do offer us your observations of what we all have in common. So let's talk about some of that.
Yes. Yeah, so that is a critical point. And that was one of my main objectives. Because after closely observing American society for the last 30 years, I've been in this country 31 years now. And especially lately with all the tensions and everything that we're going through as a country, and I've become a naturalized American citizen, and so everything that's going on here is it's something that interests me as a citizen. And so having traveled around, I like to tell people that I feel like I've met everyone from everywhere in the world. In the Soviet Union, it was, as I described, it was mostly people from the global south. And so you met people from everywhere in Africa, everywhere in Latin America, everywhere in Southeast Asia, from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. And then I came to America, and some of the schools I have studied in, I went to Purdue University for my master's in engineering, and then later on I went to Dartmouth. And these two places, you go there and you meet everyone else from the global north. And so Western Europe, Australia, Japan, Canada, you name it. So you put those two together. I mean, I feel like I have met people from every culture, every place on this planet. And the one thing I have realized that regardless of where someone comes from, I mean, what culture they come from, what religion they practice, what language they speak, there are some very fundamental things that we all as humans believe and cherish. So the first one is love of family and close friends. People, you know, wherever they are from, I mean, when they have children, their siblings, the love they have for them doesn't change. It is the same, whether you are black, brown, white, that it is the same. And we all have this innate desire to be treated with dignity and fairly. So fairness, dignity, love of family, close friends, Those are human qualities. There is nothing white, black, brown about any of those. And so that is, I tell people that the best education I got in the Soviet Union was living with my Soviet roommate for 1 year in Kyiv. I went to the Soviet Union fearing that the KGB was going to spy on me incessantly, because that is what I've been told by people. And so I went into the country, and right off the bat, started suspecting everyone I met. And in the dormitories we lived in, we the foreign students were paired with Soviets. And right away, I thought, this is the spying that I heard about. But living with my Soviet, his name was Dmitry, lived with him for 1 year. And by the middle of that year, I realized that he was the best human soul I had met up to that point in my life. And so today we read about Russians and Ukrainians, what is going on over there, and so when I look at that conflict, And incidentally, where the war is raging, I lived in Kyiv for 1 year. That's where I went to language school. And then I lived in Kharkiv for the second year. And then I went to Donetsk for 4 years. And so my entire 6 years in the Soviet Union, I lived in Ukraine. And so Eastern Ukraine. And so I had a lot of interaction with Ukrainians and Russians. And I know these people well. I know the landscape. And so today, looking at what is going on and everything around it, the global reaction to it, for someone like me, is very disappointing. Because as I say, regardless of who we are and whatever our backgrounds are, we are all humans who aspire to be treated with dignity and respect and fairly and. So that's my view on that.
Patrick Asari, thank you very much for joining us on Book Spectrum.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, once again, the book is The Boy from Bantwa, One African's Journey of Hunger and Sacrifice in Pursuit of a Dream. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on anywhere you get your digital books or the paperback. You can pull that through Amazon and anywhere else as well. Patrick, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
So you can find me on my website. At my website is patrickasariauthor.com. You can find me there. And I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is POKWASI. That's my Twitter handle. And I'm on Facebook, Patrick Asari. And LinkedIn, you can find me under Patrick Asari. So you can find me in multiple platforms, and primarily on my website. You can, and I have a blog on my website as well. So you can find me at patrickasariauthor.com.
Patrick Asari, thank you again for being with us on Book Spectrum, and thank you all for listening.